Hello, ladies and gentlemen. It is my voice without Nick's or the music, which can mean only one thing. There is no new podcast this week. I am still recovering from the injection in my hip and just really busy catching up on things. So I think it is better that we save the new episode until next week when I can focus fully on it. So for this week, we are going back to an episode which we talked about last week, which is why are so many students stuck at a band 6.5 for writing? This episode is not currently available on our feed. So if you've been listening back to our old episodes, and this is episode 5, right? So we're going way, way back to 2020. So even if you've been listening, you are not able to listen to this episode back in our back catalogue. So this, for many of you, will be a completely new episode and one which I think you will find interesting. So enjoy, and I'll be back next week. Take care until then. Here comes the music. Bye.
Welcome to My IELTS Classroom, the podcast where two ex-examiners talk all things IELTS. I'm Shelley Cornick.
And I'm Nick Long.
And today, the big question: why are so many students stuck at a 6.5 for IELTS writing? Is it a conspiracy, or are there some good reasons why so many people get that score?
Hello, everybody, and hello to you, Shelley. How are you today?
Hello, I am very good. I have been on a history marathon.
A history marathon?
A couple of days. Yeah, have you heard of the British, he's not a scientist, he's a journalist. His name's Graham Hancock.
I haven't actually.
Okay, so it's really interesting. I heard a podcast recently, and he has this theory that most people, so archaeologists, most archaeologists say that like civilizations like started about 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And this Graham Hancock, he thinks that they actually started way earlier, like there were huge civilizations in like 12,800. So it's like 10,000 years earlier. Mm-hmm. And his like whole theory is that around the world, there are all these different, in all these different places, people were building pyramids.
Right.
Which seems a bit strange. Like, why would everybody, like, you know, in Egypt and South America, mm-hmm. and, you know, why are they all building pyramids like the same shape? And why are all these pyramids pointing at the same stars in the sky?
What?
Yeah, so they kind of like all sort of like orientate or like point towards particular stars. And sometimes now when you look at the sky, there's no star there. But if you understand what was in the sky 12,800 years ago, it was all pointing at the same star. Ooh, right. So he has this belief that there was this civilization and then this huge meteor came and then everything flooded and was destroyed. But maybe a few people survived and then they passed on this information in different places. Mm-hmm. So I've been basically just watching. So I started by like watching all of the stuff from Graham Hancock and I totally believed it because it sounded amazing. Mm-hmm. And then I started watching loads of like BBC documentaries full of real scientists who are just like, no. It sounds great, but no, it just doesn't work. So I thought that's the reason I thought that was a really interesting thing is that in the we finished our last episode, right, by talking about this question, this idea of this myth. Why do so many students get a 6.5 for writing? Is it a conspiracy? Are the British Council working against us to do this? So it's a bit like Graham Hancock, right? He's got this theory.
Yeah.
And we can't just say his theory is not true. We have to look at his theory and we have to make some decisions. Like we have to decide, could it be that there is this real conspiracy? Mm-hmm. Or are there other more scientific, realistic reasons for why students get a 6.5? Does that make sense?
That's a very good analogy, actually. Because as soon as you said that, I was really keen and interested to go on YouTube after we've done this and go and have a look for Graham Hancock and discover what this theory is about. But I guess
you should. You really should. Even if, because who knows? Like they keep discovering more and more things that make him look like it might be real.
Okay.
But
so you haven't led me down the garden path then, no?
No. It's definitely interesting anyway. So what I thought we could do today then is let's imagine that I know that a lot of students get 6.5 for writing and get a 7 or higher for the other parts of the test.
Yeah.
And for many students, that 6.5 is stopping them. It's stopping them migrating to another country or becoming a doctor or just being able to relax at home at the weekend rather than practicing IELTS, right? So I thought we'd look at, let's imagine we are policemen, investigators, and we are going to like have a look at what is happening and to decide once and for all, is there something strange happening with this writing score? Mm-hmm. Do you want to be a policeman with me?
Hello, hello, hello.
Okay, good. Right. So I think then if we're policemen, you're DCI Loan, I'm Sergeant Cornick. Mm-hmm. If we're policemen, we would probably go straight to the top, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the first place we would go, we'd arrive at Cambridge, who write the test, and we would think, is Cambridge doing something that is stopping people getting a high score for writing?
Mm-hmm.
So if we arrived at Cambridge, what do you think we would find, Nick?
I think they would. We would go in and we'd say, hello, Governor.
Hello.
Let's have a look at your files and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And we'd investigate and we would figure out that all that Cambridge really do is just write the test. They have nothing to do with the scoring and they have nothing to do with the assessment. They simply write the test.
Exactly. I think all we would find would be a lot of tired test writers
mm-hmm.
who are writing all these tests all the time.
Yep.
And, you know, just a file full of hundreds of essay questions.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think 100%. If there was some conspiracy, it's definitely not Cambridge.
Yeah.
Right? So then I think we'd have to go and find the headquarters of the British Council and IDP.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you don't know who those people are, go back to our first episode where we explain. Could the British Council or IDP be doing anything which is making students get these lower scores for writing? I personally can't see how they are doing that.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
Well, so to begin with, these are huge organisations. Like the British Council is like a well-established organisation for, mm-hmm. I think, decades. Right. Mm-hmm. So why would they do that? They would do that, I guess, because students need to take the test again and then they can get more money.
Yeah.
But there are other tests that students can take now that are accepted by governments and academic institutes.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing IELTS has got is its reputation.
Mm.
So if it was doing that, I just don't understand why they would do it. As a business model, you may make more money now, but you're going to be closed really quickly.
And the thing is, if this was happening, it would have to be a huge conspiracy and so many people would have to be quiet about it because the organisations are so massive.
It would be, exactly. There'd be like thousands of people who knew that this was happening. Mm-hmm. And also we would be, Nick, one of those people because we were trained as examiners.
We were.
Mm-hmm. And there was nothing in my writing training that said, Shelley, come here, give them a 6.5. Like, nobody said that. In fact, the interesting thing in training is that they have to train you to be able to accurately score any paper, right?
Yeah.
So we spent loads of times like, is this a 4 or a 3.5,
mm-hmm.
you know? Or is this an 8 or an 8.5? That 6.57 was not a massive focus in our training. And nobody ever said to us, hey, earn some extra cash, fail the students. Like, no. So look, I just personally don't think if there was something strange happening, it cannot be at that high level of IDP and British Council.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So then we'd have to think, okay, who's next on the chain? Mm. Maybe the biggest suspects could be the examiners because they are the people who give the scores. So what do you think about that theory that it's the examiners who are on purpose giving 6.5?
Well, I think it would be very difficult, first of all.
Why is that?
Because the writing task is marked by two different people in completely different places often.
Exactly.
So I don't know how they would conspire to give a student a 6.5.
Yeah. This is my argument. Exactly that, Nick, is that if it was one examiner, you could say, well, that person could be doing it. But if it was the examiner, it would be more logical that it would be the speaking that would be the problem. Because that's one examiner. So one examiner could make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Like one bad apple.
Mm.
But But for the writing, there are two examiners. And if one of them is a very different score, so if you had one bad examiner, like we said in the last episode, mm-hmm. those scores get checked again by a third examiner. So mm-hmm. for me, I mean, and also I just feel really sorry for the current examiners and for myself, because everyone thinks that we're bad people. And actually, I used to spend hours trying to make sure that I gave the right, the fair score,
mm-hmm.
you know, so... Yeah. So, all right, so if it's not the examiners, that means the only other people that are left are the people who work at the test centre. Mm. So that would be like the administration staff who take the examiner scores and then they put them into the computer.
Mm.
What do you think about those people, mate?
I think it's very, very unlikely, to be honest.
So do I.
Because, again, like you said before, they are a business.
Mm-hmm.
And if their reputation gets damaged or their mm-hmm. reputation gets ruined, then they don't get any more clients.
Right, exactly. And also, if the administration was changing the scores, let's just imagine if they were changing the scores,
mm-hmm.
at some point students are going to start asking for an evaluation of their results.
Yep.
And then your paper gets sent to a senior examiner mm-hmm. back in Australia or back in London, and it's going to be clear, wait a minute, this was a 7.5. Why was this entered as a 6.5?
Yep.
You know, and I think if that happened once or twice, maybe my theory about the test centres is that this is the only possible place where it could happen.
Mm.
But just because something is possible doesn't mean that it's likely.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So in the same way that, you know, I don't know, like a policeman could come to your apartment and put some stolen goods in there and say, hey, you took it. That is possible.
Yeah, it's extremely unlikely.
It's extremely unlikely, right? So I would say that, you know, it could be possible. And if you think that is happening at your local test centre, if you think your test centre is changing the results, then I guess the only thing you can do is complain to the British Council or complain to IDP.
Mm-hmm.
And they would take that very, very, very seriously.
They would investigate completely.
They would definitely investigate. I know they would, because I know a couple of people who pass on information to the investigators and then get information back.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that could be the only place where it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I still don't think it is very likely.
Mm-hmm.
And also now with this, because of the computer test, most in the past, like 10 years ago, every centre, if you went and took the test in Paris, somebody in the Paris centre would mark your writing.
Mm-hmm.
It was all local marking. But since they introduced the computer test, they now have these big marking hubs in Australia and some in China and in Canada, where it's just all of the papers get sent to those marking hubs. So it's the same examiners for every centre in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that should mean then that these test centres, if there was anything, that would be now impossible because they're not even marking the writing anymore.
Yeah.
And even if you take the the paper-based test, like at my centre, they scan that and send it to these hubs. So it's not just the computer test, it's the paper-based test. So I would say, if we were policemen, we would have looked at everyone and we would probably say, actually, possibly something could happen at the test centres, but it is much more likely, much, 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 much more likely that the student really just is a 6.5 for writing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So let's just think about that for a second before we start talking about band descriptors and why people get a 6.5. Let's just think about writing compared to like listening, speaking and reading.
Mm-hmm.
Nick, you and I, we've taught in the past and still sometimes teach a lot of general English classes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they're classes that use often the Oxford books, English file, or a Cambridge book or a Pearson book. So classic English textbooks, 6-month courses.
Mm-hmm.
We focus on lexis and grammar.
Mm-hmm.
In those classes, how much time do you spend on writing?
Well, taking English file as an example, I would say there's about 6 or 7 writing lessons in the whole book in a 6-month course.
Yeah, exactly. In a book with probably, I can't work out how many lessons, but probably, 40?
Yeah, probably about 40 lessons, yeah.
The bigger question is, honestly, did you used to teach them?
Actually, I did. I liked the writing lessons a lot, yeah.
Because I never did. All the students, you would say, and today we're going to do writing, and they'd go, ugh.
No, I love teaching writing. I enjoyed it.
That's cool. So I would say you are the exception, right? So you were teaching maybe 6 lessons in 6 months. Mm-hmm. I also love teaching writing to academic students or students who are taking something like IELTS. But to a general course, that was always their homework. Read the page about the writing, do the writing. Mm-hmm. It will take me 2 minutes to mark and it's finished. So I just think that of all the skills, if we compare it to like all of the other things we do in class, writing is a tiny percentage.
It is. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think another reason why writing skills are not as well developed as other skills is there's not that much chance these days to actually practice writing skills. Like any conversation that people do have, written conversation, is usually on social media. So, you know, it's just like informal conversation. It's not an essay. You know, writing emails, it's not really the same as writing an essay, even though some of the language can be transferable.
Maybe for the general training students, it's similar to the letter. But you're right. I mean, even when we write an email these days, it's a lot of it is just short. Like, we don't even start the formal, dear sir, madam. It's just, hey, here's the essay. Thanks. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really short. And I also think, like, there are loads of, you know, if we think about listening, right, there are all these free podcasts. Mm. There's Netflix. There's loads of ways students can watch movies, listen to English.
Yeah. So they can really practice that skill.
Yeah, same for reading. Mm-hmm. Speaking's a bit more difficult, but people can still practice speaking. I think are more likely to practice speaking, to chat to somebody, than they are to sit down and write them a letter.
Yeah.
And I also think, exactly what you said, it's the type of writing that we test in the exam. Mm. So of those 6 lessons in our general book, I bet one of them was like, write a postcard, or, you know, it's not about writing an academic essay, is it?
It's true, but it does depend on the level, because in the higher levels, like upper intermediate and advanced, there are more sort of academic style essays where you have to give an opinion or compare and contrast or something like that. But still, very, very little material.
Yeah, and probably not quite enough depth to get a really high score. Like a good introduction for like a 6 or a 6.5, but maybe not really the highest level. I would say, though, for me, maybe the best evidence that it is not a conspiracy and it is the students who are really a 6.5 is what we see every day running our school. So, like, basically, you know, in my arts classroom, you can come, you can just take video courses. That's fantastic because that teaches you everything you need. But we also offer a package where you take... You go through the video course and at the same time, you're sending me an essay to mark. And so you might watch 3 or 4 videos on one type of essay and then write that. Then another 3 or 4 videos, maybe some grammar videos. And by the end, you should have covered every type of essay and every type of letter and report. But before we start that, I always want to know at the beginning,
what's your level?
Yeah, what's your level? Who is this person that I'm helping? So I ask the students to write me a first assessment essay. And I will go through that and I will give some short feedback, not as detailed as the marking, but I will just say, okay, what is their current score at the moment? Almost never is a student a 7 in that first assessment. In fact, I think I can count on one hand the number of times that first assessment has been a 7.
Yeah, I very, very, very rarely come into contact with a first assessment that's a 7.
And if it is, it's usually a student who's working with me because they need a 7.5. You know? So when people email me or that, you know, oh, Shelley, I don't understand it. I've tried everything. I've watched loads of videos on YouTube. I've done this, I've done that, but I'm still a 6.5. They think it's a mystery. Like, it feels like a mystery. And I understand that because it is maybe quite difficult to understand sometimes. But when you or I look at those essays, it is always very, very clear.
Very clear.
Yeah. Why a student's not getting a 7. So I think for me, that is the reason why I truly, genuinely, honestly believe that IELTS is giving fair scores for marking.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's not easy for students. I know it's not nice. But I think if you can accept that, if you can accept, actually, the problem here is just that my writing's not quite good enough at the minute.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good place to start, because from there, you can learn, you can improve, and then you will be a 7.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just taking the test again and again and hoping.
But we talked about it last time, didn't we, that not that many countries really get involved in sort of academic essay writing. So it's no surprise that the skills that you really need to get a high score, some students just don't have.
Yeah, exactly. And I also think the problem is that good students think that these skills can be learned quite quickly. So they just try and, like we said in a previous episode, try and get these hacks or these tips and tricks. And actually, that doesn't work.
It can actually make it worse in some instances, well, can't it?
I think that is exactly right. It really, really can. So I think what we're going to do today then. So look, I hope you now that you maybe can see that there probably isn't a conspiracy about a writing 6.5.
Mm-hmm.
That it's just more likely that students are not quite good enough to get a 7.
Yeah.
So I think what we can do then is to really help people is, you know, Nick and I mark dozens of essays each week.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the same kind of issues appearing again and again and again.
Yeah.
Now, I have a really great ebook which you can download, which contains the 5 most common errors that I see for each of the band descriptors. So for task response, coherence and cohesion, lexical resource and grammatical range and accuracy. I think today, though, we don't have time to look at 5 for each one. But I think what we could do is, why don't we go through our, like, the problem that we see most in each area. Okay, so the first area we're going to look at is task response. And that is the first area because that's probably the score that the examiner will give you first when they're marking your essay. Mm-hmm. And we're only looking at essays today, not part one. So what is task response? Well, task response is just very basically how well you answer the task that you were given.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the band descriptors, and remember, this is all public information, there is nothing hidden. If you look at what a good student does for task response is that they address all parts of the task. They have a clear position or an opinion if they are asked one throughout their response. So not just in the conclusion, but throughout. And they present and extend and support their ideas. So that's really what I'm looking for when I'm giving a score for task response. Have they answered the question? Do they have a clear opinion? And are all of the ideas extended and supported and justified?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to start, right? For me, the biggest problem that I see here is just when students do not address the task. So what does that mean? Well, I think there are 2 ways you could go off topic with the task, right? So the first one is just you don't actually do what the question asks.
Mm-hmm.
So we spoke about, you know, there are different types of IELTS questions. So let's imagine a question asks you to discuss both sides and give your own opinion.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't discuss both sides, you have not addressed the task, right? And that sounds really simple, but students, for this type of question, students make mistakes here, don't they?
They really do sometimes, yeah.
So if you had a question that said, some people think Nick is the best IELTS teacher, some people think Shelley is the best IELTS teacher. They're both correct. No, right. You would. For that essay, you would need some arguments for why Nick is the best.
Yeah.
And some arguments for why Shelley is the best.
Mm-hmm.
And also in those paragraphs, you should make your own opinion clear as well, right? The mistake that I see is that some people think, okay, I need to discuss Nick and Shelley. So if a student had one paragraph that said Nick is the best and one paragraph that said Shelley is the worst...
Or simply, Shelley is not the best.
Is not the best. Yeah, not necessarily. Yeah, so Shelley is good, but not the best. Has that student addressed the task?
No, because they haven't talks about why you are the best, which is what the question was. Some people think Shelley is the best.
Exactly. So the question isn't discuss both of the topics. The question doesn't say discuss Shelley and Nick. The question says discuss both views.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And one view is that Shelley is the best, and one view is that Nick is the best. And you must give reasons why these people have this opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I see very often, in fact, you marked something like this today, I think.
Today, I marked something like this today, exactly, yeah.
Where the student had discussed the topics, but they'd given negatives instead of positives to one of the sides,
for one of the sides. So basically, he was only arguing for one side.
Yeah, which and you cannot do that in a discuss both sides essay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a similar thing, problem-solution essays, we often call them problem-solution essays, but actually, those questions usually contain two questions.
Mm-hmm.
And there are three choices for those questions. Some questions ask you, what caused this problem?
Mm-hmm.
Some questions ask you, what are the problems?
Mm-hmm.
And some questions ask you, what are the solutions?
Mm-hmm.
And you could be asked any mix of those three.
Yeah.
So one question might ask you, what are the causes of this problem and how can we solve them?
Mm-hmm. And it's the most common type, I think, that, isn't it?
It is usually the most common type.
Cause,
it is.
Cause and solution.
But this is where students go wrong, because they see, oh, it's a problem solution. So they automatically give the solution. But sometimes it asks you, what is the reason for this and what problems? And it doesn't ask for the solution.
Yeah.
So if you give me the solutions, you're completely off topic.
And as well, another common error in that type of essay is, for example, what are the causes and what will the problems in the future be? And the student will speak about the problems now. That's not what you are being asked. The problems are what will the problems be.
That is a fantastic point. Yes, some of them ask you to predict the potential problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? In the same way, with advantages and disadvantages question, if you're a general training student, you might just be asked the simple question, what are the advantages and the disadvantages? So for that type of question, they're just describing, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if you're also sometimes a general student or an academic student, they may ask you, you know, do the advantages outweigh the disadvantages? That's asking for your opinion.
Yeah.
That's asking...
compare, basically.
Yeah, it's asking you, are the advantages more important than the disadvantages? So if you just describe the advantages and the disadvantages, but you don't give your opinion, you're going to get a 5 for task response. So many students seem to get really confused about these tasks. And I just sometimes think, if you're confused, just read what the question is asking you to do and do it. You know, it says discuss both views and give your opinion. What should you do? Discuss both views and give your own opinion. It's not so complicated. I think a lot of information online has made it more complicated than it should be. So definitely number one, make sure you read what you've been asked to do and you do it properly.
Mm-hmm.
So if you prepare, you should never make that type of error. Really, because you should know how to address all of the different types of questions. So usually when people complete my course, they don't make that error because I've taught them what to do for each of the types of essays. The problem I see more often is when students just don't address the topic that was asked in the question. And this can happen for a couple of reasons. So I think the first reason is sometimes people just misunderstand the question. So for me, the most famous or the classic IELTS question for this was the question that said, some people believe that nowadays we have too many choices. To what extent do you agree or disagree? And what happens is most students go, choices. Yeah, there are loads of choices. I agree. And then they just write me an essay that describes all of the different choices that we have in the world today, right? Choices with technology, choices with education, choices, choices, choices. Nick, is that addressing the question?
No, not at all. Not even close.
Right. So why is it? What does it mean? It doesn't say we have a lot of choices. It says we have too many choices.
Mm-hmm.
So what does too many choices mean?
It means that it's not a good thing to have so much choice.
Right.
Basically.
Exactly. Yeah. So this essay is not asking you to just describe all of the different choices we have. It's asking you to evaluate the effect of these choices. Are these choices good, or are these choices having a bad effect? I think they're having a bad effect because I find it impossible to make a decision. I am constantly confused by choice. So it's really, really, really important that you take the time to really understand the question. I have a really nice blog post with the top three misunderstood questions in the Cambridge book. If you go to the blog, blog.myieltsclassroom.com, go to the writing section, you'll see it. It's the fourth or fifth lesson. That will help you understand, you know, other questions which are misunderstood. The other thing is students understand the task, but they sometimes don't address all the parts of a task. So I had a really great student who, you know, finally she got a 7.5 for writing. Unfortunately, she had to sit the test twice because her exam question asked, I think it was like, individuals and private companies should pay to clear up the pollution, not the government. To what extent do you agree or disagree? So she wrote a great essay about why private companies should pay and not the government. So what was the problem?
She probably didn't mention individuals at all.
She just completely focused on private companies and the government and did not mention individuals anywhere. And because of that, she would have got a 5 for task response, maximum.
Yeah.
So you really have to make sure you include all of the information that you're asked for. The other one that's common is there's a question, living in a country where you have to speak a foreign language can cause serious social problems as well as practical problems. This one is often a mix of misunderstanding and missing information, because most people who read that, living in a country where you speak a foreign language can cause problems. Yes, they always talk about work. It's difficult to get a job. Is work a social problem?
Not really.
Not really. Is it a practical problem?
Also, not really.
Not really. Most people didn't understand what practical problems means. Practical problems are like, think of listening part one. All of the things you do in listening part one, joining a gym, opening a bank account, finding your way on a bus, they are practical problems.
True.
So for me, the most important thing is read the question carefully and make sure you are really answering the question you have been given. Because if you don't, even if your essay is fantastic, you are going to get a 6.5, maybe even a 6 if you are completely off topic.
Yeah.
All right. So that was my first one for task response. That's my most common one. What would be your one, Nick?
So for me, it's this point that you mentioned before, presents, extends and supports main ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So having a good, coherent argument in an essay can sometimes be quite difficult to actually form the argument. So what you talk about on the course, what I think is an excellent method, is to introduce, support and extend an argument. Yeah. Not just introduce, which is sometimes what some lower level students do or some people who really struggle do. So for example, cats are better than dogs. To what extent do you agree or disagree? I agree, cats are better because they are cuter.
Yeah, finish.
End of argument. Well, no, you need to explain how and why you think cats are cuter. Yeah, well, that was a bit of a silly example, but, you know.
But I think it's a good clear example, though.
Yeah.
Because I think that is where a lot of students end, and particularly if they're asked, like, advantages or disadvantages. Often end up with a list, don't you?
The first advantage is that it's cheap. The second advantage is that it's, you know, works very well. The third advantage is that it, and it just goes on and on and on. Okay.
Yeah.
It's cheap. That's an advantage. Excellent. You found an advantage.
Uh-huh.
Now you need to explain why, for people, that's an advantage. Why is this product being cheap an advantage? Yeah.
Exactly.
I always tell my students to ask themselves two questions when they're writing an argument for an essay. After every sentence, to just ask themselves either how or either why.
Mm-hmm.
And that would naturally allow them to write the next sentence.
I think that sounds supremely simple, but actually that is often all you need to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the thing is that students do a good job of finding the ideas, and then they just don't go that next step.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the idea is the difficult thing.
Yeah.
So if you've got the idea, you're already like 80% of the way there. It's just then explaining it and expanding that idea.
And the idea needs to be relevant as well. That is true.
Yeah.
It should be a relevant idea.
Well, because this is the thing. A lot of people say, oh, it doesn't matter what your ideas are. Is that true?
No, it really matters what your ideas are.
Yeah. I think as we said before, your opinion doesn't matter if you agree or if you disagree.
Yeah.
But you have to have a logical reason for your opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Nick, a question that a lot of people sometimes ask is, do you need an example for every idea? So in advantages, disadvantages, if you had two advantages, do you need an example for both?
Well, let's imagine that you had an example for both the advantages and the disadvantages, yeah? So you had four examples altogether. What do you think will happen to your word count?
It'd be, what, 500?
Yeah.
It would be really high.
Exactly. So, yes, we do. We need an example in an essay, but one is usually enough to back up one of your arguments. So if we have four arguments altogether, then one example per essay is generally enough, I think.
I totally agree. And I think we're going to do a whole episode on examples. What makes a good example? Because I think that is a place where people struggle. It's too much for today. But I would say a lot of the time extending an answer is exactly, it's saying why or how.
Mm-hmm.
It is not just giving a simple example. Examples are actually not great ways of extending and supporting. They should come after the support if you're going to have them, right?
Yeah.
So I think weaker students rely too much on examples because they've been told they must have an example for each idea, but that is not a good way to do things.
Not a good way to argue.
Yeah, okay, fantastic. All right, so let's go on into coherence and cohesion.
Mm-hmm.
For me, this is kind of like the hidden danger for some students. I think students focus a lot on grammar and lexis and the task response, but they kind of just maybe ignore coherence and cohesion a little bit. Mm-hmm. And this can be the one which comes up and really gets you and brings you down to that 6.5.
It really can, yeah.
Yeah. So as we said previously, coherence is like how easily your essay can be understood.
Mm-hmm.
And cohesion is how well your ideas are joined.
Mm-hmm. Another really important academic skill.
Superly important. And not one that people really understand very well, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're going to get a 7 here, the information in your essay needs to be organized. So you need paragraphs which are logically organized.
Mm-hmm.
This is what people really focus on, but that is something you can learn in honestly 5 minutes.
Yep.
It is the easiest part of the cohesion and the really. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to have to logically organize the information inside your paragraph so that the idea and the progresses. You're going to have to use words or phrases that join your ideas together. Mm-hmm. We call these cohesive devices.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have like a clear topic inside each paragraph. So they're kind of like the main things we need to do for coherence and cohesion.
Mm-hmm.
I could talk about this for hours, right?
Yeah, so, me too, to be honest.
So Nick, I'm going to give you first opportunity this time, right? What is the one thing you see, the one mistake that is stopping students getting a 7?
I think one of the biggest mistakes is not having a clear topic sentence.
Cool. So yeah, okay. Why is that important?
Because this is, I think, one of the most important cohesive devices that we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Which signals to the reader what the paragraph is going to be about.
Right, exactly. So like we said, you have to have a clear central topic idea in each paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the topic sentence that tells the examiner what that topic is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what mistakes then is it that you usually see with the topic sentences?
Well, the biggest classic example is for Discuss Both Sides essays.
Mm-hmm.
Where we've got a nice introduction. Okay, we're going to... Maybe they've done the introduction well. They've got a clear opinion. And they've introduced both sides. And then they move on to the arguments. And they just hit you with the first argument.
Uh-huh.
Instead of introducing the side again and letting the reader know that in this paragraph, we're going to discuss the side I disagree with.
Uh-huh, cool. Yeah, so what is the main problem of just starting that paragraph with an argument? Why is that not really a good idea?
Well, I would say this is because we have, usually we would have two or more arguments in the paragraph. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we need an introductory sort of sentence just to kind of suggest that in this paragraph there will be the ideas or the arguments, plural,
yes,
for this side of, yeah, the argument. So the paragraph is not about one argument, it's about more than one argument about, yeah, this topic, which is why we need the topic sentence.
Exactly, because that is the problem. If you say in the topic sentence, you know, Nick is the best teacher because he is funny,
mm-hmm,
if we go back,
mm-hmm,
that means, if that's your topic sentence, that means that the whole paragraph should be about Nick being funny.
Yep.
Because that's your topic sentence. So if then in the middle you say, Nick is also a really great grammar teacher, now I'm surprised, what is the main idea of this paragraph? Because you've told me in the topic sentence it was Nick being funny, but, mm-hmm, now you've introduced a new idea.
Yeah, you shouldn't do that.
No. So I think in any essay where you've got more than one idea in a paragraph,
mm-hmm,
so discuss both sides, maybe problem solutions, mm-hmm, two causes, two, mm-hmm, solutions, advantages, disadvantages, your topic sentence should be a bit like an umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
It should cover the whole paragraph, yeah, so, not just the first idea.
But then again, when you're writing an essay, like to what extent, where you do have one idea per essay,
yes,
then we need a clear topic sentence which says, in reference to the question, for example, the first reason why university education should be free is, and then you give your reason. And then you move on to discuss your arguments why you think so.
Exactly, because in that type of essay, you only discuss one idea in each paragraph.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but in half the essays, it's okay to tell you what the topic is in the topic sentence. But in the other half, when you're going to, mm-hmm, have two things in one paragraph, you need that general topic sentence, don't you?
General topic,
yeah,
sentence.
That's a, yeah, really good one. Yeah, I think that's a really good one. I don't know what to choose for this. I want to talk about progression, mm-hmm, because that's something that is a problem for students. I, mm-hmm, also want to talk about referencing. But if we really think about, if this episode is about what's stopping people getting a 7,
mm-hmm,
then I think we have to say mechanical use of transition signals,
mm-hmm,
or cohesive devices.
Mm-hmm.
So that just simply means, you know, the words that we use to show the relationship between sentences. So words like in addition, moreover, firstly, therefore.
Mm-hmm.
That, for many students, is the only thing you have to do to get a high score in coherence and cohesion, is just add those words between each sentence.
That's what they think, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what they think. And unfortunately, that's not true. And so the biggest error that I see is often overuse, mm-hmm, of these transition signals. So you've got students who just automatically use them at the beginning of every sentence. And if you do that, it was going to be extremely difficult for you to get higher than a 6. So, you know, I've written a little example here. So if I'm going to read this paragraph, right, it's got 4 transition signals. So every sentence starts with a transition signal. I want you just to listen. What are the transition signals and which ones could we remove? All right. So I'll try and read this in my nicest voice. This is about living in another country, the social problems, mm, the question we discussed a minute ago. So, firstly, there are a number of social problems for those who live in a country with a different mother tongue. To elaborate, it is hard to make friends when you are not able to communicate fluently. Moreover, this is because people generally like to spend time with those they can share their thoughts with, or who they can turn to for advice, or who simply make them laugh. However, this is hard to do when your language skills are weak.
Mm-hmm.
So there we had 4 transition signals. We had firstly,
mm-hmm,
to elaborate, moreover, and however.
Mm-hmm.
Of those 4, Nick, how many could we remove from that paragraph?
Personally, I would remove 2.
Okay, cool. Which ones would you remove?
To elaborate, absolutely, yeah. 100%, get rid of it.
Yeah.
And probably moreover as well.
Okay, I agree with you, right? So First of all, I had a student recently, and it made me really sad. She sent me an essay, mm-hmm. and after the topic sentence, which you've just described, mm-hmm. she added, to elaborate, and there was another one, to elucidate, one in the first paragraph and one in the second paragraph. Mm. And I said to her, you don't need to tell me after the topic sentence that you are going to elaborate. That is your job as an essay writer. And she was really upset. She said, I paid a lot of money to learn those words. And that made me really sad because I was like, those words are stopping you getting a 7.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need anything after the topic sentence that says moreover or to elaborate. Just start your argument.
Do you know what I had actually saying that after the topic sentence? It was the same. It was like, firstly, blah, 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 blah.
Uh-huh.
What is more? I was like, whoa, stop. You don't want to discuss more now. You need to make your argument first before you've given me another one.
If you say what is more after the topic sentence, you need to add a second topic sentence. It's just, yeah, it's really bad. Also, that moreover, I agree. You don't need that.
No.
It is hard to make friends when you are not able to communicate fluently. This is because it's great. Starting sentences with this is a great way mm-hmm. of joining ideas together without using
transitional signals.
Mm-hmm. A transition signal. The only one I think we need is the however at the end.
Yeah, because it's...
Because mm-hmm. it's showing the contrast.
It is, yeah.
However, this is hard to do when your language skills are weak. We need to show there is contrast mm-hmm. here. Now, Nick, I'm so happy. I'm really, really happy that you think it's okay to keep firstly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I've read on lots of forums... Never use firstly. Examiners will give you a 6 if you use firstly. It's mechanical. It's obvious. Is that true?
Not really. If you've got two arguments, why would you not use firstly and secondly?
Exactly. It's logic. If you only used firstly and secondly, that's mm-hmm. probably on its own, like not enough to get you a 7. There are other things you need to do, right? Use referencing, mm-hmm. use other keys of devices. Mm-hmm. But using firstly is never going to stop you getting a 7. And it makes me angry when people say that because it's a complete misunderstanding
mm-hmm.
of what coherence and cohesion is. So I'll put this paragraph on our website page, podcast.myieltsclassroom.com, so you can just have a look. But in general, have a look at your paragraphs. If you are starting every single sentence with a transition signal,
it's too much.
Stop. Mm-hmm. It's too much. Try and find other ways. A bit like you said, you know, like when you said one of the problems is that people don't extend.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that you've only got one sentence for each idea, which is why you're always saying in addition, moreover, because you're introducing new ideas all the time.
Yeah.
So it could be like two problems you've got there. But if you've got two or three sentences for one idea, you should not need a transition signal at the beginning of each one.
Hey, I'm Raman from India, and this is my IELTS classroom.
Hello, my name is Michael. This is my IELTS classroom.
Hey, this is Khadija, and this is my IELTS classroom.
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 All right, Nick. So now we're going to go on to lexical resource. I know this is that you're looking forward to talking about this. So very quickly, lexical resource is the IELTS way of saying vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to get a 7 for vocabulary, you have to use a sufficient range of vocabulary to allow some flexibility and precision. So that just means that you have got some topic-specific vocabulary. So you have got the lexis you need to discuss this topic mm-hmm. at a sophisticated level.
Yep.
Better than I could in Russian or Spanish or the other languages that I speak. You're also going to need some less common lexical items.
Mm-hmm.
Just some, right? So we don't need lots and lots of high-level words, just some. And you're only going to have occasional errors in word choice, spelling, and word formation. So you can make some errors to get a 7.
Yeah, and still get a 7. Mm-hmm.
And still get a 7. That is fine, but it just needs to be occasional. So that's a difficult term to define, I would say.
I think you have to put it into context with the rest of the essay now, probably.
Yeah, you have to look at what words are they spelling wrong, right? Are they really high-level words or are they really simple words? Mm-hmm. do the spelling mistakes stop me understanding the word, or is it, you know, like, can I still read it, but there's a one S instead of two S's or something? I think two or three errors. You can still get a 7 with two or three errors.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure.
All right. So, Nick, I'm going to give you first choice at this one again. What do you think? What is the most... I know what you're going to say, but I'm going to ask you. What is the most common problem that we see? What is stopping people getting a 7?
Bad paraphrasing.
Yeah.
And inappropriate word choice.
Say, yeah. I mean, in the IELTS language, it's inappropriate word choice. But we would just say... Bad paraphrasing.
Sometimes really, really, really bad paraphrasing.
All right. So I think this is so important that I really want to be clear. Like, what do we mean by bad paraphrasing? So, like, Nick, have you got, I think you've got a few nice examples, and these are taken from, like,
from real essays. Student,
from real essays. So, yeah. So why don't you give us a few examples of this bad paraphrasing?
Well, firstly, I want to say just overall in general, when you've got a question in IELTS, if you paraphrase every single word in the question, then you'll be completely off topic. I guarantee you will be off topic if you paraphrase every single word in the question. So don't do that.
That is golden advice. Yeah. Listen to Nick on that. That is really true. Yeah.
So one of the like most popular questions that we mark that we have is, some people believe that all children should learn a foreign language from the time they start school, while others believe it is better to wait until a child is at secondary school. Discuss both sides and give your opinion. Primary school and secondary school do not need any kind of synonym. Yeah. There's no such thing as the secondary phase. There's no such thing as the foundation years. We can't change primary school and secondary school to something else. Otherwise, we'll lose the meaning. These are fixed terms, you know?
Yeah. It's really interesting when students do try to do that. Because they are fixed terms, they have to come up with something quite crazy. Like what you just said there, like at the secondary phrase or in the foundation years. If I said that to a native speaker, they would never understand that we were saying primary school.
And secondary school.
Or secondary school with those words, would they ever?
And children as well. Now, a good synonym for children is pupils. Because, you know, pupils are people who study in school. Children who study in school, pupils, excellent synonym. That doesn't mean that primary school children are young ones and secondary school children are grown-ups. But both of them completely wrong synonyms. That's not what we want. Yeah. So you need to be very careful with the with the vocabulary that you choose to change. Foreign language has a good synonym, which is second language. Yeah. Right. We don't really want to change language to tongue. That's a bit inappropriate.
Yeah.
Mother tongue maybe is okay. Is a good.
Yeah, mother tongue's okay, but we don't usually say second tongue.
Yeah, that's...
That's strange. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that question's difficult because you've got, like, primary and secondary, and then you've got which students try to change. I mean, the only one... do you think you could change them to the Americans, like elementary and high school?
I don't see the reason why you would need to, because... I mean, you could, but why?
But you wouldn't get any extra points for that. I mean, I just...
Do you know what? I think maybe the verbs are actually better to change here. Because you've got start school, yeah?
Begin,
because instead of start school as the time they start school, that's a verb. We could say from the beginning of school, which is beginning is a noun. So that's a much better change than elementary school and primary school.
Exactly. You know,
when you're paraphrasing, when you're reforming the question, changing nouns... and verbs, like verbs to nouns, nouns to verbs, is actually a really good way of doing it without changing any of the actual sort of adjectives and lexis in the text. So start and beginning are perfect ones that you could use.
Yeah, and like learn, right?
Yeah, learn.
So like you said, like instead of learn, it's like include in the curriculum or have classes in.
Yeah.
Those are the parts of this question that you should try to paraphrase. But this is a disaster for most students because you've got primary and secondary school, which don't really have a synonym. You've got children And then the students just go, like you said, like young ones, grown-ups. I mean, grown-ups are adults. They're not secondary school students.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got second language mm-hmm. or foreign language. So you've got three things which are difficult to get synonyms for.
Mm-hmm.
So what should the students do then? So if these we don't need these synonyms, what would you recommend they do?
I think it's just a good idea to be careful and to really think about it. Like, think about what kind of words you use every day. And, okay, primary school, secondary school, is there really a synonym for this? Not really. Start, is there a synonym for this? Well, yes, actually, there's begin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to think about these words where there are simple words.
I mean, synonyms. I think a good thing would be, imagine that you're talking to someone and mm-hmm. you use your expression in place.
Yeah.
You know? So if you said to your friend, is your child starting the foundation year soon?
Mm-hmm.
Would they really understand that you were asking about primary school?
Exactly.
No. So then it's wouldn't. A crazy synonym. Yeah.
But if you said, is your child about to begin primary school?
Perfect.
Exactly the same meaning. Yeah. And we've got about to begin. A lovely little paraphrase of collocation. Start. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think exactly. And also I really love what you said at the beginning. I think students focus very much on like sort of translating or each word, right? Mm-hmm. Or like paraphrasing each word individually without thinking about the overall meaning of what they're trying to say. If you think about the meaning, that will help.
The meaning must be the same. Must be the same.
Yeah, because if you change the meaning, what's going to happen? You're off topic and you're back to my problem with not addressing the task.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I hear all the time is that, and I think one of the I'm going to be honest, if you're doing this, don't feel bad. You're doing this because somebody told you you have to do this.
Yeah.
This is one of the biggest myths and lies about IELTS that I've seen and probably the most damaging.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the time what we read is just what I would say gobbledygook. That just means without meaning, right? So I think the myth is that you cannot repeat words from the task. Is that true?
Absolutely not.
Of course it's not. It's absolutely fine. If you're asked about primary school, you can use the word primary school in your answer. It's strange if you don't use that word.
The thing that you shouldn't do is copy the question verbatim, word for word.
Yeah.
You cannot do that. Yeah.
But you can use particular words from the questions which don't have, you know, like words like tourism. You just use those words. That is fine. And, you know, in my course, what I always teach is, to be honest, if you can just find one good synonym for the important terms, that's all you really need, because you can just use the one synonym and then you can use referencing. So you can say like they or it to refer back to these words, which will improve your score for coherence and cohesion. So I would say, you know, use the word from the task and one synonym and alternate them with some referencing. That would be perfect. And if there is no synonym, do not feel bad about using the word.
Mm-hmm. Just use the word.
Just use the word.
Because it would be much better than using an incorrect synonym. Much better.
I totally agree. And also, like English people, if you ask, like I said, if you're asked a question about primary and secondary school, I expect to read those words.
Yeah.
Usually students get into trouble like the further through the essay because they've got one good synonym and then they think, oh, but I can't use that one again. And that's where these crazy creations start.
True. It's true.
Yeah. All right, Nick, well done. I think definitely for lexical resource, that is by far the biggest problem that we see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sad because most of the time, the students who are doing that could easily get a 7 for Lexis, even an 8 sometimes. But those crazy paraphrases and synonyms are really holding their score down.
Yeah.
My choice for this is when students worry that their Lexis isn't good enough. And so they think, okay, I don't necessarily want to spend time learning lots of topic-specific vocabulary. So I don't want to spend time learning words to discuss the topics of education or technology or government spending. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to learn a few connecting words. So like these transition signals we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to learn some really fancy words that will impress the examiner and then they will think my Lexis is amazing. No, which is just, it just doesn't work, right? So I'm talking about students who start paragraphs by saying to embark with, right? So they put that expression before their topic sentence, yeah? To embark with, Nick is the best teacher. Well, to embark with has literally no meaning in English.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you embark on a journey. You don't embark on an essay, right? Or they say, instead of saying on the one hand, they say, no, that's too obvious. I will say on the one side, or my favourite, on the flip side.
See you on the flip side.
See you on the flip side. That is not an academic expression. That does not impress the examiner. That mm-hmm. is terrible for your coherence and cohesion and your lexical resource, right?
Mm-hmm.
We often see them in the conclusion. To recapitulate. I don't even know what that word means, right? Or
no
my favourite one, by way of a conclusion. That means it's not a conclusion, but it's like a fake conclusion. Anyway, my point is that, sadly, you can't really fake lexis, can you?
No, not really.
You know, you've either got the vocabulary to discuss a topic or
you don't
have mm-hmm. the topic. And adding these words is just making you look weaker, maybe, than you are.
I would say so. And it doesn't impress me when I encounter these phrases. It just annoys me, to be honest.
Well, this is, I mean, in my ebook, I say every time a student says to recapitulate, an examiner dies.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just...
It's nonsense.
Like, please stop. Yeah. All right. So that's lexical resource. And for many of you, that's probably the best advice that we can give you today,
mm-hmm.
I think. Because there are a lot of students who are losing points there where they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Because of what Nick said, because of the bad paraphrases. My IELTS
Classroom. Hi, my name is Ehsan. I am from Pakistan. I studied with My IELTS Classroom because it is one of the most comprehensive courses which you would not find anywhere else. Another thing which I liked about this course is that Ma'am Shelley teaches every IELTS concept in a simple and humorous manner, which keeps you engaged in the course throughout your IELTS journey. My IELTS
Classroom. All right, so then let's look finally at the grammatical range and accuracy. So for this, to get a 7, it's all about two things. It's about using complex structures.
Mm-hmm.
So are you able to use language which is complex? So mm-hmm. we would consider like B2, C1.
Mm-hmm.
And are you able to produce error-free sentences?
Mm-hmm.
So really, you know, the range is the type of sentences you're using, and the accuracy is that you are not making mistakes.
Yep.
You also need to have good punctuation.
Mm-hmm.
But usually punctuation is never a reason to stop somebody getting a 7. That is not often the main problem.
Unless it's really, really, really bad, I would say.
Unless, I would say the biggest problem is students who just put commas
everywhere.
So if you don't know how to use commas, I promise you, don't use any is better than using 20
too many,
unnecessary ones. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to go first this time. So for me, the biggest obstacle to a 7 is students not having quite a wide enough range of sentence structures.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's not because the student doesn't have the language to create the sentences. It's just that they're not showing me enough in their essay.
Mm-hmm.
And a good example I can give of this is sometimes students don't realise that they're using the same type of sentence again and again and again. So some students love conditional sentences, right?
Mm-hmm.
They use if all the time. Some students love relative clauses, like which, particularly result ones,
mm-hmm.
yeah, which means that, blah, blah, blah. They are all fantastic, but if I can only pay you, like give you points for each structure kind of like once,
mm-hmm.
really. So if you're using not only 3 times in an essay.
I marked one like that recently.
Yeah,
every single sentence was not only, does it? And it's just like, oh.
Yeah, it's like not only is fantastic, but only if you use it once, because it sounds unnatural and you're not showing me the other things that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say a really good thing to do is have a look at one of your recent essays and have a look at the different types of complex sentences that you're using. If
mm-hmm.
you don't know what a complex sentence is, go to my website, watch my first lesson it's a free lesson in the grammar course, Introduction to Complex Sentences. That's at www.myieltsclassroom.com. Just see what you're doing. Are you really showing a good enough mix?
Mm-hmm.
Now, all I will add to this is I often see people say, to get a 7 for grammar, you must use a conditional sentence, a passive, I don't know what else, like since. That is not true. There is no checklist for examiners when they are marking your writing.
Does he
right?
have it's, this one? Does he have this one? Does he have this one?
It's not bingo.
No.
So although like a well-used conditional sentence is good, mm-hmm. it's actually a first or second conditional is only around a six, to be honest. So that's not really a seven anyway. In my ebook, I've got a nice little grid that shows you different sentence structures for mm-hmm. different levels. But I always want you to think, yes, we want to show a range, but you also really want to use grammar to make your arguments. Don't do it the opposite way. Don't try to include, oh, I must include a conditional, I must include this, because then you end up with some strange sentences and essays that don't read very well. If you focus on your argument first, mm-hmm. your grammar should follow your arguments, right? Yeah. So you're... but you do, although we don't want to have a list, a checklist, you do also at the same time want to make sure you're not repeating the same structures again and again. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I will say about complexity is that we talk a lot as teachers about complex sentences. However, there are lots of other ways you can show complexity in your language. So if you're a student who's looking for a really high score, like an eight, the complex sentences are great, but also using modal verbs, right? Like we discuss hedging, mm-hmm. yeah? So like using modal verbs, adding adjectives and adverbs to your sentences, which is what students forget quite often. Mm. Having noun phrases, making comparisons. There are other ways that you can show complexity.
Yeah.
So really think about that. But I would say, number one, have a look at what you're writing now. Are you using all of the same types of sentences, or are you showing a nice mix? We really need a mix for us to be able to give you a seven mm-hmm. or higher. Okay, mate, what is yours? What's your biggest obstacle to a seven for grammar?
For me, it's a basic error, actually. Fairly basic error, mm-hmm. which is subject-verb agreement. Mm-hmm. Or as I like to call it, the bane of my life. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
No, but it is surprising how many of our students make errors with subject-verb agreement, yeah. actually.
And if you make subject-verb agreement errors, then you're going to be a long way from a seven, I'm afraid. If you consistently make them, at least, like one is okay, I suppose, but...
Mm-hmm. So what would be an example of a subject-verb agreement error, like a common one that we often see?
A common one would be the children thinks that, blah, blah,
right.
blah.
Right, so we've got the children plural,
and then
thinks,
which is
a singular.
Yeah, singular verb. Yeah. Or the opposite one, a child think that he is, you know.
Yeah. I'm always surprised when people say it, like it bring rather than it brings. So I think... You should never make a mistake with it, but lots of people write it and then a plural verb.
Mm-hmm. It bring, yeah.
Yeah, which is strange. I've got a nice lesson on subject verb agreement on the blog. Mm-hmm. So go to the blog and in under the grammar one there's a list of rules. But that is definitely the one. I didn't include that in my original grammar course.
Mm-hmm.
And I regret that now. I'm about to start making a new YouTube video, and that's the first one I'm going to make, because that is definitely a major problem. What are the other sort of like common grammar errors that we see? So I think subject verb agreement is one.
Articles, but I mean I completely understand articles, because it's not a feature of many languages.
No.
And I think if you're learning English and your language doesn't have articles, then it can be really, really tough.
Do you think article errors would stop somebody getting a seven?
Not a seven, no, I don't think so.
I don't think
Unless
so,
it was like really, really severe. Like if it really hampered the meaning, which it often doesn't.
I think that would be the systematic error that could stop you getting an eight, but maybe not quite a seven.
Mm-hmm.
The one I'm thinking of is the contrast, problems with contrast clauses. That is what kills me.
Yeah.
So, like, our students often start a sentence with while or although.
Oh, God.
And then what do they do? They put a but
full
in
stop,
the middle.
Or a but or a full stop. Yeah.
Or, yeah, they say, while some people think this is bad, stop. And then that is a fragment. That's half a sentence.
That's not a full sentence, yeah.
No. Or they put a comma after although or while.
Although, comma, yeah.
Yeah. Although, comma, but, stop.
I had one today that was I had not seen for a long time, and it was if followed by a full stop.
Wow. Yeah. A full stop.
So it was like it was a conditional sentence.
Uh-huh.
But after the first clause, yeah, full stop.
Oh, so it was just the first half of the sentence.
Mm-hmm. If cats like chocolate, full stop. Well, what? Finished. What if they like chocolate? You haven't explained to me.
Bye. I finished my sentence. No. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've got if you have problems with those although contrast sentences, the second video, in fact everything we said, the second video in my grammar course
will be about
it's
that.
Free is about contrast clauses, and the third one is about articles.
Oh great.
Yeah, so they're all there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think accuracy, I mean, at the end of the day, the grammar score is quite clear.
Yeah, right? Like it really is, yeah.
Black and white, really. Mm-hmm. You can either make these sentences accurately or you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in a strange way, if you're unsure why you're getting a 7, a 6.5, grammar, you know, even if you put your essay into a Word document and switch on the grammar
checking.
Error check,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you've got loads of red lines underneath, well, probably it's your grammar.
Mm.
Okay. We didn't mention this at the beginning, but just to be clear, if you're going to get a 7, you're going to need a 7 in each of these areas.
Yes.
So if you've only got a problem with one, that is enough to keep you at a 6.5.
I've got a little question for you, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, what if you get 8.776?
Then that's a 7.
It's a 7, yeah?
Yeah.
But the average must be over 7 or over, yeah?
Exactly. The average must be over 7, yeah. So So it's not, you don't need a minimum of 7. It's mm-hmm. just that the average must be 7.
So if you get 7.776, then that's a 6.5.
That's a 6.5.
And one area is letting you down and holding you back.
And sometimes that's all it is, you know? Yeah. And sometimes it could be the coherence and cohesion. So students mm-hmm. come and they're like, oh, I wrote this, I did this. And then you read it, it's like, but you haven't used referencing, or you've got too many transition signals.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, we're just talking about essays. Don't forget about task one.
Yeah.
It could be that it is your task one, which is really weak and is letting you down.
It really could be.
Yeah. So, all right. So, that was really our 15th truth or myth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Why do so many people get a 6.5? If you have a question or a topic that you would like us, or, you know, if you've got a question, you know, you want to know if it's truth or if it's myth, or if there's something you would like us to discuss, please, please, please email us at hello@myieltsclassroom.com.
Mm-hmm.
And we will try to include your question or your idea in a future episode.
Do you think we're going to do future listener episodes?
I'd like to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So send in your questions, you know, yeah. We'll answer them.
I think it's fantastic when people, like, I can sit at home and invent ideas or things we can talk about, but if it's actual people who email me, then that makes me feel like I am providing a service, or we are providing a service that people want.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to, what are we talking about next week? Well, it's a mystery. Well, it's very futuristic, definitely. And it is, there's a lot of trust that you have to go, you know, into into trusting that they're not looking into your computer while you're doing the internet. So that's what we'll be discussing in the next episode. To make sure you don't miss it, remember to subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or any podcast provider. And we'll see you next week. My IELTS Classroom podcast is a production of My IELTS Classroom Limited. Nick and I do not represent IELTS, and everything you heard in this episode is our own personal opinion. You can find the show notes and transcript for this episode on our blog. That's blog.myieltsclassroom.com. And if you're looking for our video courses, speaking lessons, and marking service, you can find that at www.myieltsclassroom.com. If you have a question or query or just want to chat, you can email Nick and I at hello@myieltsclassroom.com. Our theme music is by Heartbeat, and our artwork is produced by David Brown. Have a great week, study hard, and remember, this is my IELTS classroom. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.